The subject for tonight's she'er is anger and how to avoid anger. In the next chapter, we've got the following story. And Yishai's three elder sons who had followed Saul went to war. Now this was the war against the Philistines that resulted afterwards in Goliath. And David and Yishai, that is the father of David, and Yishai's three elder sons who had followed Saul went to war. And the names of his three sons who went to war were Eliab, the firstborn, and the second to him, Avinadab, and the third was Shammah. Now, the one that we are concerned with most at this particular stage is Eliab, because he's going to crop up in today's shear. And David was the youngest, and the three eldest followed Saul. Now, David went to and fro from Saul to tend his father's sheep in Bethlehem. So David was busy with his father's sheep, and the three elder, the three brothers that were older than David went to war. And the Philistine drew near morning and evening, that was Goliath, draws near morning and evening, and presented himself 40 days. And he was taunting the Bnei Israel and telling them, if you are so strong, take somebody out amongst you and let him fight me. And Jesse said to David, his son, now take now to your brothers an ephah of this parched corn and 10 loaves of this bread and rush into the camp to your brothers. And you shall bring these 10 cheeses to the captain of the 1,000 and see how your brothers are faring. And you shall take the tidings of their welfare. You shall see how your brothers are faring, and you shall take the tidings of their welfare. It's rather interesting. Take the tidings of their welfare is a euphemism. And the euphemism is, he arranged, their father arranged, that they should have, that they should divorce their wives when they are in war. In case they are taken captive or in case they are killed, then the wives are able to remarry. And this was something that we did also in this last war. We were very careful about that. When soldiers went to war, they gave instructions to the Bote Din in various parts of the world to write gittin, to write bills of divorce for their wives in case they are found missing or they are captured and there is not sufficient evidence to pronounce death, which means it's doubtful whether this woman is still married or it's not. And then there was the divorce that was given. And when the divorce was given, either the woman is a divorcee or she is a widow. And that is what David did. His father sent him, when it says, and take the tidings of their welfare, that is a euphemism for bringing arranging the bills of divorce for the wives.
When you said this last war, you meant the 1939-45 war?
Yes, 1939-45.
Yeah, yet there were
so many wars since then, haven't there? Yes.
But there have been a number of agudas there that, well, that's not the right word.
It is agudas.
Agudas that did have problems, weren't there?
Well, it depends, you know, it depends where you are and what you are and who you are and when you are. It depends. Some people don't know about it, don't worry about it. It depends in what society you mix. And the answer to that is always choose your friends and choose the society in which you mix. But those people mixed in the society of in a Jewish society, this was well known, and this was something that was worked out very carefully, and it was done. at the beginning of the war, I found myself in London, and then there was a young man from Canada who came over to see a cousin of mine, and he came over here just, he was just married, he was an officer in the army. He had just married, and immediately my cousin got busy with him and he arranged a gift for his wife, but he had just married. And I still remember it so clearly. He said to my cousin, "Will my wife know about this?" He said, "Of course not. She doesn't have to know about it. She knows nothing about it. But if a problem should arise, he's covered." And that is what they did there. You seem so puzzled, Mary Jo.
Why wouldn't the wife know about it? Why would it be improper? You alluded that it was improper.
Just look, a woman is just married, and her husband says, "I've arranged a divorce for you." There's a lack of delicacy. There's such a lack of delicacy. There's such a lack of sensitivity. Arranged a divorce for you. Of course, he doesn't want to speak like that.
Okay.
I remember once a person coming to me, he's got a wonderful idea. That there's so difficulty sometimes when a man doesn't want to give his wife a divorce, a wife doesn't want to give a man his divorce. Let him put into the kasuba that he's going to, then he'll get out. I said to him, "You know, I would never put my name to a kasuba like that. Now, where's the delicacy? Where's the sensitivity? Put in just getting married and have a clause inserted about a divorce. One doesn't do that sort of thing." You follow Mary Jo?
Mm-hmm.
So he was quite right. He was very sensitive. He said, "Will my wife know about this? Just married and she's already informed about a divorce. It's much better. What does she have to know about it for? And God forbid anything happens, its preparation is there for." You follow?
But she may not know about the preparation and never be able to take advantage of it.
That is very carefully arranged. That is very careful. The records are. Everyone is there and it's advertised immediately. Any problems? This is the place where you get in touch with. Oh, that's very carefully. In a well-arranged society, these things take their place. As it happened here, these wives didn't know anything about it. That's the way it was arranged. Right? Ruth, what did you want to ask?
That was my problem. If she doesn't know about it, then if he's killed, then
no,
what?
See, it goes,
you know, where does she know to apply to find out whether she's a husband or a widow?
But take I don't know how things work in the United States of America. I don't see why they shouldn't work well. The difficulty about the United States of America is that each synagogue has, each Orthodox synagogue is its own law. If it's its own master, that doesn't matter. But each Orthodox synagogue is its own law. And one finds sometimes Orthodox synagogues doing things which are, say the least, improper. Because there isn't, they are not accustomed to this sort of thing. In Israel, there is a control. In England, there is a control. In South Africa, there is a control. In France, there is a control. In Germany, there used to be a control. In Belgium, there's a control. In Holland, there's a control. And it's so arranged that there is an independent Beit Din. And an independent Beit Din is a Beit Din where those who sit on the Beit Din are not functionaries doing perfunctory duties. But they are people who have independent minds and they are put into a position of independence, and the president of a congregation can say, "I come along, I want you to do this and this." And the rabbi will say, "Well, I can't do it without the Beit Din." And the president knows that that's his death knell. That's the way the rabbi does it. Otherwise the rabbi might be dependent on this man for his position. There is no such thing. He goes to the Beit Din. The Beit Din is an independent body. The president can't do anything to the Beit Din. And that controls the ecclesiastical side of the synagogue. So everybody knows the Beit Din. All the records are there. Every soldier that goes out, they know about Everything is there. Just my question about it. Got it? Right. And Saul and they and all the men of Israel in the valley of the Terebinth were at war with the Philistines. And David rose early in the morning and he left the sheep with the keeper. Saw to it that there was somebody looking after the sheep. And he came to the barricade, and the army which was going out of the battle array shouted in the battle. And the Israelites and the Philistines put the battle in array, army against army. And David left the baggage in the hand of the keeper of the baggage, and he ran to the battle array, and he came and he greeted his brothers. And while he was speaking with them, behold, the champion named Goliath, the Philistine from Gath, was coming up from the ranks of the Philistines, and he spoke the same words as before, and David heard. The words were a challenge to the Israelites. Come out and, what do you want to have a fight for? If you have a fight, look how many people get killed on both sides. Let us do one against one, so only one is going to get killed. At most, two will get killed. It's a duel. So you'll profit in any case, says Goliath. But he was, of course, taunting. And all the men of Israel, upon seeing the man, fled from before him and were exceedingly afraid. And the men of Israel said, have you seen this man who is coming up, to taunt Israel? And it will be that the man who will kill him, the king will enrich him with great riches, and will give him his daughter, who will make his father's house free in Israel. And David said to the men who were standing before him, saying, what shall be done to the man who slays that Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? And who is he that he should taunt the ranks of the living God? And the people said to him, so shall be done to the man who slays him. Tell them the story. And then comes the telling phrase, and the one that concerns us this evening. And Eliab, the eldest brother, heard when he spoke to the men, and Eliab's wrath was kindled against David, and he said, why have you come down? With whom have you left? Eliab was the eldest son of Hishai. Eliab was the one whom Shmuel thought would be the king, and he thought that it was he whom he was called upon to anoint as king. And you remember Hashem says to him, it is not he because I have rejected him. And last week's shiur was on the subject of that rejection. Why was it that he rejected him? And I explained to you, it becomes apparent only in the next chapter when Eliab displayed anger towards David. The display of that anger invalidated him from being king. He was the one who was originally to be king. But because he had anger within him, although he had not displayed it at this time, but because he had anger in him, he was not a person that was suitable to be king. And now you remember that last week we discussed at great length the Mido of Kas, that is the attribute of anger. And I dealt with it from two points of view. The one, I told you that there was a Mido of Hamtana. Now that is not so far. I have covered with you 12, is that right? Have you all got the 12 attributes that I've covered with you?
Yes,
12 attributes. This is not one of the attributes that I've covered with you, but an attribute that a man has and which a human being should develop is the attribute of Hamtana. Hamtana is deliberateness. And the way we used to be taught that was you count 10 before you say anything. Now we were taught that not by Jews but by Gentiles, because once upon a time in schools the teachers taught this to their pupils and to their students. And when we were children, this is one of the things we were taught. If you get angry, don't say anything until you've counted 10. That is a nidah. That is an attribute, it's a good attribute, and we call it hamtana, deliberateness. And if you want to, you can put down that attribute. And that is a 13th attribute that you have to deal with. These have got nothing to do with the 13 attributes of Hashem. These are attributes with which we are dealing as we go along. And this attribute of Hamtana, this is not the matter, this is not really the subject of the Shir. I'm just briefly going over a few matters. The attitude of Hamtana is in everything in life. One is deliberate about everything one says, also about everything one does. One thinks it over before saying it, before doing it. Be deliberate. It's good advice. It is a midah that it is worthwhile developing. Eliav didn't show that at all. He lacked Hamtana. But worse than that, he had the attribute of anger, which is amongst the two worst attributes that a human being can have. The one is arrogance, and the other is anger. Now, when I spoke to you last week about Hamtana, deliberateness in avoiding anger, I want you just to realize that when we were taught not to be angry, and when you were probably taught not to be angry, the reason that was given was, if you want to be listened to, if you want to make your point, if you want to score your point, if you want to get what you've set yourself out to get, you won't get it by being angry. You be calm. Play it cool. That's good practical advice, but that's not terrible. That tells you how to get your way. Very good in business, but that's not terrible. Hamtana, yes, it tells you how to deal with it. You are angry. It surged up within you. How you discipline yourself. Be deliberate. Think it over. Don't rush into saying anything. Don't rush into doing anything. But why don't we get angry? What is the reason that anger is so bad? The total reason for it is because it reduces in one the Tzelem Elohim, one's image of God. How does it reduce the image of God? That has been the subject of my shiurim now for several weeks. Man, when he becomes angry because of himself. Somebody has injured him. Somebody has injured his pride in whatever way it might be. And since somebody has injured his pride, his eye has been touched. He increases his eye with his anger. He increases his own image. He asserts himself. And as he asserts himself and increases his own image, he decreases the Tzelem Elohim in him. And that, of course, is the basis of so much which we have been discussing. Every person has been given this image of God. We started off on the subject. If every person has been given this image of God, can he ever lose it, or has a person always got this image of God? No matter how low he falls, no matter how low he sinks. And the Torah answer is one can diminish the image of God. One can reduce the image of God. And with this reduction, and with this diminution of the image of God, as he reduces it, the reason for it is he increases his own image. And where man increases his own image, there he reduces the image of God. The two can't possibly go together. That more or less brings us to where we were, accepting, before I leave the question of disciplining oneself, and I said one of the reasons was Hamtana, it was deliberateness. One of the means is deliberateness. There's one other way in which one also does it. far more difficult than being deliberate, and that is being self-sufficient unto oneself. Now, no person can be entirely self-sufficient to oneself. It is impossible, and we don't want a person to be self-sufficient unto himself. We want interdependence, but interdependence in such a way, that he is not dependent for his sipuk nefesh, for his spiritual satisfaction, on anybody else. He's able to achieve it himself. That is something that's very difficult indeed, but I'm mentioning it to you now for what it is worth. To come back to our subject, and that is that anger is something that when one becomes angered, it is to increase one's own image. As one increases one's own image, one reduces the image of Hashem. In the King, this is especially important. And now I'm repeating all these foundations which we have already laid down in these chiyuvim. When one speaks about the purpose of man, according to the Torah, the purpose of man is to bring Hashem into the world. How does one bring Hashem into the world? That anyone who sees the way this man behaves in his speech, in his carriage, in all his movements, in what he does, in how he does it, in what he says, in how he says it, you can say that this man must be a creature of Hashem. That is the purpose of the creation of man, and that is the purpose of the creation of everything, that it speaks for itself. Occasionally we see it. Occasionally we see it in nature. We should always be able to see it in a human being. Of course, I'm speaking about the idea. This is the most difficult thing of all to achieve. The King is the very example of it. He is the example of it. Through his life, he must show that. Eliyahu is a man who could become angry. He's got it in him. As it happens afterwards, we see it afterwards. That is not a man that can bring to the world the idea of Tzelem Elohim, that God is everywhere. The person who can do it is only the person who has got the Tzelem Elohim, the image of God, to a most remarkable degree. He can only have that to a most remarkable degree if his own image is in him. But as soon as his own image is projected to the fore, it reduces the image of Hashem in him. That, more or less, covers the subject of anger that we have spoken. I've put it all that we have discussed, I've just put into a few words, and now we can go further. Is that all right? Yes.
Hashem, many times was angry with the Jews, with his people. So we are to be, as much as we can, reflect his likeness. So that's
very
one
good
thing that disturbs me about this.
Very good. That's an excellent question, but you could have asked a slightly better question. And then the answer is the same for both questions. The slightly better question is, if anger is something that is so despicable, if for anger and for arrogance, not to be confused with pride, the Rambam says there is no room in the man for that. There is no room for God and man to be in that. And that is the Gemara over and over again, where Hashem says, where there is arrogance and where there is anger, I cannot dwell. And we've had it, where a man is a prophet and he becomes angry, his prophecy departs from him. We had it last week in Shul with Moshe. With Moshe Rabbeinu, when he became angry, you remember that part? Where he became angry, immediately became angry. I'm coming to that. So if that is the case, if anger is something so bad, why have we been created with anger? Everything that God has created in us is for good. So he has created anger in us, and anger should also be for good. You say quite rightly, but God becomes angry with us. So how do we explain? And that is also the Rambam, and I touched on it last week, and that is when the Rambam says the only justification for anger is when a person simulates anger. When a person is completely in control of himself. Completely in control of himself. But he shows his displeasure by being angry. But then he's got to be. But it's completely in control. And it's not because of himself, but it's because of something that is outside himself, and only then can he really be in control. That is the only time. When a child does something, and it is wrong, and the parent is angry, but the parent is angry not because the child has disobeyed him. That's not the reason. The parent is angry for one reason only, and that is that the child has done something wrong, and is angry only because it is a means he is employing in order to correct the child. That the child must know his displeasure, but completely in control of it. And then it compares to the anger of Hashem. And that is the only anger that is permissible. No other anger is permissible. You follow him, Peter. But it's a very good question.
Are you saying then that Hashem uses that type of anger?
That type of anger he uses. He uses that type of anger where it's nothing against him, really. This is what the person is. It's wrong, what the person does to himself. And he displays anger to us. And he conducts himself that way, but it is an anger that is completely under control, and that is the only anger that is permissible. No anger, no other anger is permissible. These are the two things. This is, the Rambam, I told you, will never say anything that is his own. He will never say it without a source. Whatever he says has got a source. So he can never be wrong. He's not saying his own, he's saying terrible. The Rambam can never be wrong. Nothing without a source. There are about four, there was one thing that he was questioned on as to where, three things he was questioned on to where was his, the source of it. And he couldn't, there were many things he was questioned, he always gave his answers, his sources. There were three things he was questioned, and you can imagine the person who questioned him. A person who doesn't know anything would never dare go to the Rambam. A person who knows a little would never, might go to him, but he'll never ask him anything. A person who knows a lot might ask him something, but he would never say to him, from where did you get it? What is your source? It's only a person who knows a tremendous amount that he's gone through all the sources and say, you know, I don't know. Everything the Rambam was able to answer, excepting three, and he withdrew from them. He withdrew from those three decisions that he gave because he couldn't find a source. Nothing that is in the Rambam is without a source. And that is, this is our source. The source is the Torah Shebaal Peh. And once it's the Torah Shebaal Peh, that's divine, that's Hashem. For arrogance and for anger. Where there is arrogance and where there is anger, Hashem says, there I cannot be. If a man has got wisdom, or if a man has got prophecy, that he loses through a display of anger. And it's not as a punishment, because it just cannot go together. And of course, when we speak about wisdom, we speak about wisdom in its greatest form. Wisdom in its greatest form cannot exist where there is anger. I think that now covers it. Yes, Gemma?
This is not from Torah, but I recently was talking to a person who deals with children and psychologically counsels them. And I was amazed that he was counseling parents to always be in control and always to always be in control and never to say anything that ideal.
Yes.
To a child without first being in control of what you're saying and not to be angry.
Yes, well, I'm very glad to hear that, because this is something that's only beginning now in the secular world. Until now they said, if you're angry, get it out of you. Mm-hmm. Break the crockery. Destroy the glassware. Rip up the upholstery. Get it out of your system. It, of course, is absolutely contrary to Torah. It's only very, very recently that there's a little bit of this going on, that there's such a thing as controlling and disciplining oneself and others.
And set an example by
yes,
your...
Yes, and as I say, this is comparatively, yes.
Well, I've heard for many years that one should express anger in order not to repress it and become ill. I don't know what to do with that information. Is it totally wrong?
I can only teach you Torah, and Torah is reality. According to the Torah, that is totally wrong. Totally wrong. It's not a question of suppressing. It's a question of controlling. It should never come to suppression. When it comes to that, then it's disciplining. But it should never come to it even. It should be so under control that it doesn't come to it. And should it come to it, then there's the question of disciplining. For disciplining, one uses hamtana. One uses deliberateness in order to overcome it, to discipline it. But it should never come to it. Right? I know that there are many things that I teach you that comes into conflict with the outside world. I can only teach you what the Torah says. Follow?
Mm-hmm.
Now can we go further? Now we come on to, once these, in verse 8, Vayikro Yishai el Avino do Vayavireyu Vaya Avireyu Lifnei Shmuel Vayomer Gam Bezele Vuchar Hashem. Then Yishai called to Avino Dov, to his second son, and he made him pass before Shmuel, and he said, also this one the Lord hath not chosen. Vaya Aver Yishai Shamo, and then he made Shamo to pass before him. Vayomer Gam Bezele Vuchar Hashem. And Shmuel answered, this one also Hashem hasn't chosen. Vayaveh Yishai Shivas Bono Bitnei Shmuel. And Yishai causes his seven sons to pass before Shmuel. Vayomer Shmuel and Yishai Levochar Hashem Bo'ele. And Shmuel says, Hashem has not chosen any of these. The word reject he uses only with regard to the elder son. That is with regard to Eliyahu. But with all the others, he just says Hashem has not chosen any of these. Now, each one of these was a man great in his own right. Otherwise, they would never even have been the suggestion that they could have been king. Each one was great in his own right. Eliab of these seven sons was undoubtedly the greatest. But he had a flaw in his character. And the flaw in his character invalidated him from ever becoming king. Vayomer Shmuel, verse 11, and this is really from where tonight's shiur starts. Vayomer Shmuel el Yishai, hasamu hanochorim. And Shmuel turned to Yishai and said to him, have the young men that you have at your disposal ended? Is this all? Vayomer, and he said, Ar Hakoton, the youngest still remains. Behine roe batzo, and he is shepherding the sheep. Vayomer Shmuel el Yizkai shilchobo v'kolchenu. And Shmuel says, send for him and take him. Kilo nosov ad bo ofo. I would like to translate those last words, because we shall not begin eating, we shall not recline in order to eat until he comes here. Have you got that, or have you got we shall not turn away?
We
shall not sit down to eat.
We shall not sit down till he comes.
Till he comes. Well, the correct meaning for that is nosobu, is the same word that you will be using on Pesach, the subim. That's the same word. It means recline to eat. And don't forget, this is the time that they are performing the sacrifice. So it's a question of performing the sacrifice. He says, we won't recline to eat until I have settled this question. As soon as he's performed the sacrifice, he wants to get away as quickly as possible. Doesn't want to hang on. Doesn't want Shaul to start asking any questions. This he's got to finish as quickly as possible. And now comes the beginning of the story of David. Vayishlach v'yivieyu v'hu admoni im yefei enayim v'tovrohi. And he sent and he brought him v'hu admoni. The word admoni means he is of red complexion. Pardon?
Adam.
Yes, red. That wouldn't be so serious. But there's something that makes this very serious. And that is that we've used this expression once before. With Esav. We've used it with Esav once before. And what kind of a man was Esav? A bad person. He was a person who killed. The man with a red complexion. In Yafei Einai, with beautiful eyes, a Tovrohi, and a very fine person, and a very fine appearance. Now, there is one interesting departure here, and that is, he doesn't say, and he is of a red complexion, and his eyes are beautiful, but he says, of a red complexion with beautiful eyes. And the way the Midrashim take that is that the two in this person goes together. With Esav it was Admoni, and that's all it was. It is true that this man, the red complexion, and it wasn't just a red complexion, it was very, very red. And you know what happens when a person becomes angry, becomes very, very red. And this was his natural complexion, this was his natural color. And the Chazal say, he was a man who had bloodshed in him. Esau was a man who had bloodshed in him. Like in Yafei Einai. Now, Einayim, the word Einayim is always used, the eyes are always used where a man looks where he is going. He controls himself. He controls himself to such an extent that this, that he has, the ability to kill, will be used only under complete control. David becomes a warrior. And a very good soldier. He kills Goliath. He overcomes the enemies of Israel. He fights against the Philistines and he overcomes them. That is in him. But at the same time, this complete control. The Tovrohi, we usually translate it in a good appearance. In the Gemara, the suggestion is made that when one is in his company and one sees him, one is reminded always of the Torah. When one looks at him, the whole conduct of the man, all his behavior, as we've gone through it, his carriage, his bearing, his speech, his actions, his movements, his deeds, the way he says what he says, the way he does what he does. It always brings to a man, this is the Torah. That is what qualifies him to be. Vayomer Hashem kum meshochehu kizehu. And Hashem says, arise, anoint him, for this is he. Now, that is where I'm going to stop for the time being. And there are two subjects that I want to deal with you as arising from this. I'm taking the easier subject first. The easier subject is on the question of, it tells us that he was a shepherd of sheep. And there are two midrashim in this respect, and I want to deal with both of them. There's one other midrash in connection before I leave it, where the midrash says on these words, when Shmuel saw that David was an Admoni, Misyorei, he feared. The Omar, and he said, Ach ze shofech domim ke'esov. This person is a killer like Esau. Omar lo HaKodesh Baruch Hu, Hashem said to him, Im yefei einai, but with beautiful eyes. Esav midas atzmo hu holei. Esav kills as a result of his own will. He wants to kill and he kills. Avoze midas Sanhedrin hu holei. This one will never kill on his own. He will only kill when the Sanhedrin says it is necessary to do so. And the people of Israel never went out to war unless the Sanhedrin said that they were permitted to go to war or that they should go to war. There was always that control. And the Sanhedrin were called the eyes of the people. They were the ones who guided the people. The Sanhedrin were called the eyes of the people. That is just a midrash, by the way. And now there are two other midrashim I want to bring to your notice with regard to the fact that he is a shepherd of sheep. The Midrash says like this, Hashem Tzadik Yivcha. God tests a righteous man. He will never test a wicked man. He will never test one whom he knows will not be able to master the test. Hashem tests only the person whom he knows will master. The idea of the test is to make actual that which is potential. That is the reason for the test. There are tests in which we fail, but those are the tests we have put ourselves into that position. Hashem will never put us into a position giving us a test where we will fail. We put ourselves into that test. But any test into which Hashem puts us, that is a test in order to make actual that which is potential. Some power within us in order to take it out, to test it, and then we are able to use it. And what is it you wanted to ask?
But, how do we know
their
wicked deeds aren't failures of tests?
They are failures of tests to which they... That can happen. That a man puts himself to a test. A man puts himself into a position where there's a tremendous amount of temptation. But that is not a test into which Hashem gives him. Hashem will only put him into a test. Being on a test, it was with Abram. That is the classic example of the test, where Hashem tells him, How far would it go? Obedience to Hashem, belief in Hashem, trust in Hashem. How far does it go? He tests him all the way. Avraham understands. But there are two types of it. We put ourselves all the time into temptation. That is a different thing altogether.
Since most of us are somewhere in the middle, we're not totally wicked, hopefully. Well, we're not totally
I think
righteous.
You needn't say most, you can say all of us. Yes.
You know, I mean, I guess we could never know, is it a man-made test or is it from Hashem? I mean, when we fail, you know, is it because we're just inherently evil, so we know we're going to fail? I mean, that would almost seem kind of negative. Or we should say, gee, we've been given this test to show our potential because we're righteous. But we're not righteous. So
I'm not dealing actually with the test at the moment, it's just coming up. But I wanted to explain to you in what difficulties we find ourselves as soon as we come into the question of test. What difficulties we find ourselves. Take yourself now. Take yourself before you were exposed to Torah. There were certain things you did or you didn't. It was never a test. You just didn't know about it. Or you had heard about it, but you didn't relate to it. It didn't mean anything to you at all. That's not a test. And you did things which were wrong, and you didn't do things which you should have done. It's not a test. It's not a test. The test only began when you began to know about it. And even then it didn't really begin. It only began when you knew about it and you understood it. And even then it didn't begin. It only began when you knew about it and understood it and related to it. And it meant something to you. Then the test only started. Then it started as a test. Am I making myself clear? Now you are in the position of a test. At this very moment you are in the position of a test. Now it's become a test. And so it goes on in life. The things to which you are now put to the test, I'm not put to the test in those things. Not because I'm better than you, I've had more opportunities than you, and those are things. I'm not tested on that. To some people, going to a football match on a Shabbos afternoon, if they can't go, it's the end of the world. And if they don't go, it's a terrific triumph. If I don't go to a football match, I think it does me any good. I don't go, wonderful. I didn't go to a football match in the Shabbos afternoon. I wouldn't even know what to look for if I didn't go. It just doesn't mean anything, you see. Each man has got his own tests. The greater the man, the greater the test. Don't think that if he's a great man, he hasn't got a great test. It's more sophisticated, it's more refined. It's on a very, very high level. Moshe became angry, put himself into it. One can put oneself into a test, into a position, and also emerge triumphantly, outstanding, very good indeed. But those are not the tests of which Hashem. This is not what it means when Hashem actually puts a righteous man to a test. Like this, we are always in a battle. If there isn't a battle, then life isn't worthwhile living. Battle has always got to be there. Yes?
Okay, so when something happens which appears to be a test, and you fail, but from that you learn a great deal, then that isn't really a test from Hashem, that's just something...
Well,
you see what I'm saying?
I know what you're saying. It's not right to say that it isn't altogether, but I don't want you to find comfort in failing in a test. But that's what you were saying.
Well,
you were saying, and if you fail in your test, you have learned something. You learn when you overcome, not when you fail.
But you can overcome once you've learned. It's just like you said with Anne, that once she understood and could relate to it, then it had meaning.
It only becomes a test after she understands.
So, but what I'm saying is that when something occurs and...
But let me put it to you this way. When you have learned the thing, and you've understood, and you've absorbed it, and you relate to it, and it's got meaning to you, and then you do wrong, you don't learn anything. You failed. Mm-hmm. But if you do right then you've gone a long way. You follow? That is what I told Anne.
Right.
Don't find comfort in failing in a test. Small comfort. You don't learn anything. You don't become a better person through that.
But nobody succeeds all the time. What I'm saying is that
when
the failures are maybe not the test. Maybe that's before you've absorbed it.
That is a different thing.
And maybe
thing.
It helps
then
you
it's
to
not
absorb
a,
it.
Then it's not a test. Then it's not a test.
It's just a learning process. No.
I mean, for a person who doesn't know that he's Jewish and he doesn't go to Shul on Yom Kippur, it's a very fault. It doesn't mean anything. It hasn't even started, you see. It's not his fault, he doesn't know. Just speaking where we are. And of course, it's a belief that the greater the man, the greater the test of the case. He's not tested with the test. He's tested with great things. Look what Abraham is tested. Greatest thing of all. Anyway, here it says, Hashem tzaddik yivcha. Hashem tries and tests the righteous one. The Midrash says, and with what does he test him? The Midrash says he tests him in the matter of sheep. How he tends to his sheep. And we've got two examples of that. The one example is with Moshe, and the other example is with David. When Shmuel comes, where is David? He's with his sheep. The importance of that is because that is where the test was. Test in what kind of a way? There he is already preparing himself for it. Now there are two Midrashim which I'm going to read to you. The first one says, Hashem tested David in the matter of the sheep, and he found him to be a good shepherd. What did he do? And he explains, and this is all taken from various parts, various verses in the Tanakh. He says he used to, first of all, take out the bigger sheep, the older sheep, and they used to nibble at the bush, and they would nibble, don't forget this was in the desert, they would nibble at the harder part of the bush, and when they had taken the harder part, then the stubs that remained behind were softer than those. Then he let the younger sheep go and graze, and they got the more tender, the stubs which were more tender. And then, after that, he used to take out the very old sheep. And so he arranged his flock in such a way that each one would be able to eat and get the required food in the best possible way. Hashem tested Moshe with the sheep. As he was looking after the sheep, a lamb ran away from him until he reached a brook. When he reached this brook, he bent down to drink. When Moshe reached it, he ran after it. He said, I didn't even know that you were running away because you were thirsty and because you were tired. So he put him up onto his shoulders and carried him back. These are the two instances that are given. That is one midrash. There's another midrash which brings both these things and tells us as follows. What did David do with regard to the sheep? He attended to them in the wilderness. That we know from the last chapter which I mentioned to you, the next chapter which I mentioned to you last week. Eliab, when he saw him at the battle scene, said to David, what have you done with your father's sheep in the wilderness? With whom have you left them? So they were in the wilderness. With the story of Moshe, we are told that he led his sheep far behind in the wilderness, far away in the wilderness. Why did they bring the sheep into the wilderness? So that they shouldn't graze on someone else's pastures. And that would be theft. So to avoid any theft, he took them very far behind. And these are the two things that qualify Moshe and David for leadership. The way they looked after the sheep. If you want to know a person, you test him only in the small things in life, never in the big things. It's easy to be heroic in the great moments in life. It's very difficult to be great in everyday small things. That is where you test the person. That is where he becomes great. David and Moshe were great in that they were tested in the matter of the flux. And now the next thing. They seek him. He's not amongst the seven brothers. Look how the father explains. There still remains the young one. That is David. He is feeding with the sheep, and Shmuel said, send for him and bring him. He is not available. The two qualities that distinguish David are his humility and his sneeze. When he is wanted there, he is not to be found. These are the qualities that were regarded, that were required of the king whose descendant was going to be the Moshiach. We don't know who the Moshiach is going to be. There is the tzniyus. Now this is also got very much to do with the tzelem Elokim, with the image of God. The tzniyus is the underplaying his own part, the understatement in what he says, the covering up of his own personality. That is the very essence of David's whole life. He's with the sheep, he's nowhere to be found, he's got to be sent for, and he's brought here. And that is the tzniyus. Tzniyus is, as I've told you, that the two worst attributes that a person can have are arrogance and anger. And the Gemara tells us, and the Rambam brings it as law, that where there is arrogance and where there is anger, there cannot be the Shekhinah, there cannot be God's presence. Can't possibly be. Which means that as soon as there is anger and as soon as there is arrogance, there is an increase of the image of the self and a decrease of the image of Hashem. The reverse of that, where there is the decrease of the image of Hashem, the reduction of oneself, the reduction of one's own image, is in Tznius. A word that I cannot possibly translate into English for you. Can't translate it. Covering up, that's literally what it means. It's the only attribute where it says that with that attribute, one is together with Hashem. You remember in Micah, and now, oh man, what is it that is good for you? And Hashem asks of you to do justice, to do loving kindness, and to walk with the Lord your God. And to walk humbly with the Lord your God. Where there is tzniut, playing down of the self-image, that is where man is with God. The remarkable thing is that God has got this attribute to a remarkable degree. God is only found when you search Him. If you don't search for Him, He's not found. He's only found when you search. Otherwise, He is hidden. The word Olam, which we translated as world, as universe, comes from the Hebrew word which means hidden. It's that which is really the universe, which is Hashem, the Creator, who keeps the universe going, that is hidden. It's not to be seen. And this, therefore, becomes the greatest quality of all. But then we can go on. I don't think I need labor that point anymore. I've spoken to you also about that. The reason why we pay so much attention to women displaying tznius. The first redemption from Egypt came because of the women. And we say that the Moshiach will come, it will be because of the women. It will be the tznius of the women that will bring Moshiach. That is really the attribute which is closest to Hashem, which we are expected to emulate. And of course it's got very much to do with humility. Now, in verse 13, or in the verse 12, Vayomer Hashem, Kum Meshocheyu Kizehu, Hashem says, arise, anoint him, for this is he. Vayikav Shmuel, and then he said he must stand for him. Vayikav Shmuel is Kerna Shemen, and Vayim Shachaser Bekerev Echom. And Shmuel took the horn of the oil, and he anointed him in the midst of his brothers. Vatitzlach Ruach Hashem El Dovid, and the Spirit of Hashem lighted upon Dovid. I'm not going to deal with that today, I'll deal with that next week. May I yell my hoop or boiler from that day onwards. Vayokom Shmuel vayelech Romoso. Shmuel arose, he went to Romo. Baruch Hashem soro me'im Shaul. And the Spirit of Hashem removed itself from Shaul. Uvi asatu ruach ro me'is Hashem. And there troubled him an evil spirit from Hashem. Vayom ruach de Shaul elom. And the servants of Shaul said to him, Hineino ruach Elohim ro'o meva'itecho. There is an evil spirit of God that disturbs you. Yomar nu Adoneinu avodecho lefonecho, yevakshu ish yodeya menagein bakino. Let our master say to his servants that are before him, let there be sought out a man who knows the art of music. And it shall be when this evil spirit takes hold of you, that he shall make music with his hand, and it shall be well with you. a bad spirit is, a good spirit is, when there is complete harmony within the human being. And that harmony can be on so many different levels. There is harmony between what he thinks and what he says. No flattery. No untruth. That is harmony. There is harmony in his relationship with his fellow man. That is a harmony. If there isn't that harmony, then there is a dissonance in his own makeup. In nature, we find that there is harmony as far as colors are concerned. There are colors that harmonize. There are colors that clash. In music, we find that there are notes which harmonize, and there are those which produce a dissonance. When music plays, and there is that harmony, it has a soothing effect on the person. And that is what they ask him to do. That he senses the harmony of the notes and of the tones. And this produces the effect. And then a very strange thing happens. Vayomer Shaul el Avodov, and Saul says to his neighbors, to his servants, Re'u no li ish meitiv lanagein. Seek out for me a man that is able to play. Vahavi asem Eloi, and bring him to me. Vayan echod mehana orim. And one of the young men said, answered, Vayomer, and he said, Hinei ro isi bein lehishai. I have seen a son to Yishai. Now nobody knows that he's been anointed king. Nobody knows it. Except his brothers and his father. I have seen a son to Yishai the Bethlehemite. Yodeya Nagein. He knows how to play. V'gibor Chayil, and he's a mighty man of valor. The Ishmil Chomo, and he's a great soldier. Unevon Dovor, with deep understanding. The Ish Tua, and of handsome appearance. Vadunoi Imo, and the Lord is with him. Is there anything wrong in that? Yes.
How is he a soldier, a man of war? I thought David tended the sheep.
Well, he knows what he possesses, which is true, because he proves himself to be a man of war. He leads the armies.
But not at this time, he hadn't done it.
He evidently sees that it's got him in him. What is wrong here? Yes,
well,
Alida.
I say, up to this point, we see him only as a shepherd.
Yes. Well, this person, we don't know who he is yet. Vayan, and he answered, and he said, I know of somebody. Yishai has got a son, and he's got these qualities. This is the man that you need. That's of course. He says too much. He's not asked to say that. All he's asked is, all that is needed is a musician. That is what he say, what he's needed. So he says to him, he says, Yodeyat Nagein, he knows the art of music. Stop there. The Gibor Chayu, the Ishmil Chomo, Unavon Dovor, the Ish Tohar, Vashem Imo. What is he doing here? Well, that's putting it mildly, overstating the case.
Not letting things be hidden and come out.
It's a direct opposite of what the problem that Saul's having. To say that, you know, and the Lord is with him.
Yes,
at the time that Saul knows the Lord's spirit has left him.
Excellent.
It's putting the two in opposition to each other immediately.
Yes. Now, I just want to see what happens. He says, Yodeya Nagein, he knows how to play. What does Saul think?
Fine.
Fine.
Mm-hmm.
He says, the Gibor Chayil, mighty man of war. What does Saul think?
I can hold my own.
I can hold my own. And I've got a son. Who is his son? Bjarnason? All right. So he doesn't know music. Doesn't know music. Igabella. The Ishmael Chomor and the man of war. All right. Can hold my own. Jonathan can hold his own. Unavon Dovor. Great understanding. Who doesn't think that he's clever? Still doesn't worry him. The Ishtoa. Good appearance. Saul. Head and shoulders above anybody else. Yehonasan. Bahashem Ima. And there he gets him. There he gets him. He said he hasn't got it. Doesn't know if his son has got it. Hashem should be with him. There he's got him. This turns out to be the Iago of the whole of David's life. This is...
I didn't understand that word.
How do you pronounce it? In a very cartoon. He is the villain and the scoundrel in Othello. He is the one that comes to Othello and undermines Othello's trust in his wife. This is Doeg. This is the first time he puts his foot forward. Now he's going to make the mischief. And he watches Shaul very, very carefully. I've got the man for you. Yodayan again. He can play. So he's all ears. And then he goes, a mighty man of valor, a good leader in war, deep understanding, fine appearance, and he's watching Shaul all the time, and Shaul is unmoved, not disturbed. He can cope with all that, and so can Jonathan. Bashem Imo, he knows he hasn't got to say anything, or he's got him. So he'll get David, and he's sown the seed already of distrust, of hatred, and of jealousy. He's already sown the seed before he gets it. And this is Doeg. This is the mischief maker in the whole life of Arthur. We'll get him over and over again. He always rises to the surface.
Doeg.
In English, D-O-E-G would probably do. Vayishlach Shaul Malochim El Yishai. And Shaul sends messengers to Yishai. Vayomer Shilcho Elias Dovid Binecho Asher Batzel. And he said, send to me David your son that is with the sheep. Vayikach Yishai Chamul Lechem. And Hishai sends a measure of bread and a bottle of wine and a lamb, a kid of the goats, into the hand of David, his son, to Shaul. Vayomer David el Shaul, vayamer lefono, vayeho veyume eil, vayhi lo nosei chelik. And David came to Shaul, stood before him. He loved him very much, and he was his armor bearer. That is as far as we take it today.